Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Peter Phillips. Peter is a Sonoma State University sociology professor. He's also the former director of Project Censored. He's currently president of the Media Freedom Foundation. It works together with Project Censored, doing investigative research, and of course, putting out information, the kind of things you never get on what I call scoundrel media, scoundrel TV, scoundrel magazines, scoundrel broadsheets. They're run by scoundrels. What do you expect them to do? Well, not the alternative media, and not what the Media Freedom Foundation does, and not what Project Censored does for many, many years. Thank heavens we have them. They're an antidote to the poison that we need to spend an awful lot of time coming back against so that enough people know what's going on and maybe they'll do something about it. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's terrific having you. I had Mickey on some days back, a week or so ago. I lose track of time. It goes by so fast. And I sent an invitation to Andy Roth to come on a future program. I'm sure when he spots my email, he'll get back to me. Hopefully,
will. He loves to do that.
Oh, I enjoy it very much myself. And it was great being on with Andy a few weeks ago. And eager to have him back again. Oh, my goodness. In the email I sent you this morning, I suggested whatever else is on your mind. How about the EU winning a Nobel Peace Prize? Talk about straight out of Orwell, Peter.
I heard that. I mean, my thoughts about the Nobel Prizes are that they're certainly the Peace Prize is political. I can't ever imagine that Obama deserved one. So I don't pay a lot of attention to it. I hadn't really even thought about it from a commentary perspective. That the EU would get a peace prize for what? Bombing Libya? I mean.
Well, I mentioned them again in an article I'm working on today for tomorrow. That indeed. I mean, what do they do best? I mean, they may want NATO. NATO slash the EU. 21 EU nations. NATO member states, 28 NATO member states, 21 of them come from the EU. What better way to say thank you for the Nobel Peace Prize than launching another war against Syria, Peter? That was the thought I had in the article I'm working on now.
Yeah, and to a certain point, self-congratulations. I mean, NATO is globalizing. There's a new book out called The Globalization of NATO.
Oh, yes.
And which I ordered and I'm looking forward to reviewing. And but it's quite clear that NATO is becoming the police force for the transnational corporate class of the world. So wherever capital, wherever the hedge funds want to play, NATO is going to be there and protect that capital.
Well, there's no question about that. I guess that's NATO's role, Peter, to further. Well, America is the lead funder for NATO. And basically, from what I can determine, America calls the shots. And NATO is what I call an all-for-one, one-for-all organization. If one country gets involved in a conflict, all the others have to come in and help if asked. And I just can't imagine why these tiny little countries want to get involved in something like this. They don't have a dog in these fights. I can't understand why they ever wanted to be a NATO member in the first place.
They get paid to do it. Well, one, you get weapons for your own internal security. So if you're the government in power in Romania, you're going to get weapons and be supplied. Plus, if you get to send your troops off to foreign lands to engage in combat or peace missions, so to speak, it's a training process. So you have battle-seasoned troops that are at your beck and call back in your own country when you need them.
Well, as far as I know, the weapons they have to pay for themselves, Peter. Do they get any weapons given to them?
Well, no. They have to buy them themselves, but there's deals made, and there's foreign aid provided, like we do with Israel, to varying extents, depending how much you're cooperating. But if you do send troops overseas, then, I mean, that's the way the U.S. was bribing other countries to join the coalition in Iraq. So you'd actually pay them.
Well, America, of course, is famous for handing out bribes, either bribes or threats or a combination of both, Peter. I'm just looking at a list of the NATO states. It's hard to remember all 28, but I knew Luxembourg was in there. And I'm saying, I mean, Luxembourg, I'd have to double check. It's a very, very tiny country. I think you could drive from one end to the other in short order. I don't know what the population is, but I'm sure Chicago is probably much, much larger. What on earth does Luxembourg want to get involved in a war for? It doesn't have any enemies. Do you think Washington would dare ask Luxembourg to send a contingent of its local police to get into an imperial war? It's hard to imagine. Maybe it would.
They have capital. They invest.
Oh, they sure
their
do.
Their banks are, of course they're involved. I mean, that's what we're really talking about in the world today. The transnational corporate class, the 1% wealthiest 40 million people. But inside of that, the 1,000th of 1%, the 6 or 7,000 people that are the highest level richest people in each of these countries, that are managing and controlling the central banks of the world and the major banks. So, and those banks are in collusion with each other. We know about the LIBOR manipulations, where billions of dollars were looted from various trust funds around the world and investment funds by manipulation of the exchange rates. Barclays was right in the middle of that. They're international. But Barclays is tied right into BlackRock, Inc. They have mutual boards of directors, a cross-management agreement. BlackRock, Inc. is the largest investment fund in the world. It's $3.3 trillion. Now, that concentration of wealth in one place, and they shoot for and try for a 7% return every year. So they're not investing in old mortgages. They're the ones that, these are the hedge funds that will manipulate currencies, look at exchange rates, do naked short selling on a certain company, meaning that you actually sell phantom shares, but it'll drive the prices up and down. They make a profit and run away. It's technically illegal, but it's still done quite extensively in the New York Stock Exchange, although Europe has banned it. But it's manipulation of the market. It's manipulation of the trillions of dollars. And so this 1%, they in turn hold somewhere between, according to BBC, $20 to $30 trillion in wealth hidden in various safe bank accounts around the world. That's invested all over, but they're not paying any taxes on it. So there's returns to a bank in the Bahamas, let's say, that is not taxed by someone who lives in the U.S. They're supposed to claim it, but they don't. So this huge amounts of money is very highly concentrated. That's what the world economy has become, and that's what's being protected by NATO worldwide and the U.S. with all our military bases, because we're the biggest investment capital concentration group in the world, here in the U.S., trillions of dollars. And they want to be able to manipulate that and invest it anywhere in the world that it's going to get a return. And they don't want any interference from little countries and laws and environmental laws and regulations in various places.
Peter, I agree with all of that. There's no question about that, including the manipulation of the markets. There is nothing legitimate about all the financial and commodity markets and currency markets and the rest of it. Everything is manipulated by the big boys, the big banks in Europe and America, the big hedge funds, and they all work together. They're complicit, and ordinary people can get their heads handed to them if they get involved in the wrong things at the wrong time, and the big boys do everything illegally. I mean, their business model is grand fraud and grand theft, grand fraud, call it anything you want. This LIBOR business was probably the biggest scandal ever, and yet it quiets down, it gets swept under the rug. A CEO
don't even know what it is.
I'm sorry?
They don't know that they're, you know, the reason that their pension funds took a 30% drop, and now we have a pension fund crisis. Whether it's CalPERS or CalSTRS or some of the biggest or any other one in Iowa or wherever, they all got hit hard, and they were manipulated out of money. They knew their elite people knew that these things were going to crash. They knew that the subprime mortgage rates were not sustainable, that those weren't something that would be maintained. And now we've seen, you know, millions of foreclosures on people's homes across the country, and that just continues. Many people lost major value in their homes. They thought they had an equity, and then they don't. If you're in that situation, you were cheated. You were manipulated. You were manipulated into it with the speculation that occurred, and you're the one that faced a loss. So if your 501k dropped or your pension plan is under threat of being cut, or your city went bankrupt and they're not going to pay you, and you were, you know, a city clerk for 40 years and now the city's filing bankruptcy and you're not getting what you'd been promised, all of that is criminal. These are state crimes. And when I say state, I'm talking about corporations and government people together are committing crimes. Because the government doesn't regulate it, doesn't investigate it. The naked short selling should have been investigated by the federal government, and it wasn't. They just knew that this massive amount manipulation of billions of dollars was ongoing and did nothing to control it.
Well, again, I agree completely, Peter. These people couldn't get away with what they're doing without cover given to them by the big governments, whether it's America, whether it's Britain, France, Germany. I mean, they're all in this scam together to one degree or other. And everything going on, I mean, the big boys are getting the help that they need. The scandals are swept under the rug. Ordinary people are being hurt so much. And the prescription during hard times is to make it tougher on people. It's absolutely astonishing, Peter. I'm not young enough to really remember what went on in the Great Depression, but I certainly read enough about it, and I wrote a little bit about it. And the policies then during hard times were the exact opposite of now, where you create stimulus, you get the government involved where private business isn't doing it. That's the time, really, for government to step in and be the economic rescuer of last resort, to call it something like that. And during the Roosevelt administration, my God, there were millions of jobs created. During the Obama administration, from the day he ended office, with all the losses, to where things stand today, it's roughly a net zero. Obama created jobs. What's never talked about is the lousy ones, for the most part. America's industrial base is located overseas, for the most part, and the jobs created are the low-pay, low-benefit, or no-benefit service jobs. And to get by, people need two of them. If they're married, they need a spouse having a job, and they're still struggling to get by. And I quoted from a U.S. Census report some months back that the New York Times wrote about. I was very surprised, where the U.S. Census Bureau said, half of the U.S. households are either impoverished or bordering on it, and they use a decades-old formula with something like $23,000 for a family of four is considered the borderline between being above or being below the poverty line. Well, a family of four in Chicago cannot live very well, if at all, on $23,000 a year, unless they want to skip meals, maybe live in some shanty someplace, skip health insurance because they probably won't get it if they have a job. I mean, literally live a wretched existence, deep poverty, really serious trouble that they're in. I'm not certain that double that amount for many people, especially in the city, downtown Chicago, very expensive in all the major cities, the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, New York, any of the major cities. I mean, people need a decent income to live in. And Peter, any of us who are old enough remember how much more reasonable prices were decades back compared to what it costs today. And the example, I've got a few examples I love to use for myself, but when I was a grad student and I wanted to tide myself over with health insurance at the end of the 1950s until I went to work and got the coverage from my company, I took out a year's policy, It was a decent policy that covered everything I was concerned about, especially anything catastrophic. I paid $100 and change for a full year's coverage health insurance, and I'm just guessing. I don't remember all the provisions in the policy by any means, but I'm just guessing that a policy like that today, even for a single individual, would cost maybe on the order of $10,000. So if what I got maybe for 110 or 120 might cost $10,000 today, that's pretty shocking.
Exactly. My first job was Don's Union Station in Lodi, California, at $1.30. You know, I think I made $1.35 an hour. Gasoline at that time was 36 cents a gallon, which was, he was actually high for the town. And that $1.35 an hour was worth more in buying power than minimum wages today. It was like 50% more. So we've got what historically we talk about a new deal. Today we have no deal, either from the Republicans or the Democrats. And working people are taking it hard. And where they thought they had some security in their pension funds and that, that's all being devastated. So, you know, your house values, you know, everything. So we've been looted. The middle class is being looted by these massive centralized banks and hedge funds manipulating the market, concentrating wealth, and building a police state to protect it all globally. And that's incredibly dangerous. I mean, we're really looking at some serious economic catastrophes down the line.
Well, that's the other side of the coin, Peter, that you mentioned, that there is a security state apparatus in place to go after people who may not be too happy about what's being done to them. So when people go out on the streets, whether it's in Europe, whether it's in America, Occupy Wall Street has been brutalized. The cops come up and out and really do a number of them. People who come out and protest nonviolently, that's their right. That is in the Constitution's Bill of Rights. Everybody has the right to assemble peaceably, but you'd never know it the way the cops come out and beat up on people. It's the same thing across Europe. But I think at some point, Peter, push will come to shove, and enough people will be harmed so severely, maybe it will reach a point where they have a hunger issue, where they're not certain how they'll be able to feed their families, or heaven forbid, if they literally can't afford to buy medical coverage or whatever, despite the law, the way the law reads, you've got to get it or you pay a tax. Or maybe they can't afford it, so they don't have it, and they have to pay a tax, making things harder for them. But when they can't get the medical attention they need, when they can't feed their families, or if they're unemployed and they can't find a job, or they've been dispossessed of their home, and they're really at their wits' end, that's when the fuse really not only is lit, but may explode. And people, at some point, things are getting so bad that I honestly believe that the point will come when people will react and they'll go out and they simply won't take it anymore. And those are the sparks that revolutions are made of. And yet the policymakers just keep turning the screws tighter and tighter and tighter on people, helping the rich get richer, helping the majority of people in the country really get more seriously in trouble. And come the first of next year, right after New Year's, there is an automatic $1.2 trillion in sequestered cuts coming largely out of domestic programs, and much more to follow after that. Already agreed on, Peter, is something like $4 trillion in cuts, mostly out of domestic programs, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, stuff like that. I mean, people need help, and in hard times, they especially need help. Instead of getting help, more is being taken out of their hides. I don't know how much more of this people can take, Peter.
Well, unfortunately, what happens or can happen without major organizing among working people and people with some means and some resources to engage in nonviolent non-cooperation of various sorts, if we are unorganized, if the Occupy movement doesn't grow and expand, or something like it, the breaking points will be the inner cities. That's where the poorest people are. And if those become desperate situations and the police forces can't maintain, we'll see martial law. And we'll see the implementation of that with U.S. military, the North American command going in and occupying cities. That's when we completely lose it. With martial law implemented, everybody is subject to arrest and detention. The laws are in place. If you're a suspect or you're a leftist with spoken out about these issues, you've been identified, and your life will be severely restricted if we reach that point. That point is inevitable. And unless we can really organize in a massive way and have like 10% of the people in the country assembled in nonviolent resistance and helping each other out in small groups all across the country, interconnected and talking to each other, it's just going to get worse. And a Romney presidency would probably accelerate that, and an Obama presidency will not stop it. So it's up to working people. It's up to the supposed middle class, the 90% of us who kind of get by, to protect what we have and to seriously organize and build a resistance movement to top down power and police state. We have no choice.
Yeah, I agree, Peter, and I absolutely agree that I think the point is coming. I think they've gotten ready for it. There have been millions of these, forget what they call them, certain type bullets that have been bought that will be in local areas to be able to, maybe for the cops and maybe federal forces as well. U.S. Troops can be sent out on the streets. Of course, there's National Guard, local police. Local police have been militarized. They've got weapons. It's been a while, but I wrote about that some time ago. I think it's a few years ago now. But literally, I mean, there's an interconnectivity among state and local and federal authorities, and they know that what they're doing sooner or later will erupt in something more serious than what we've seen so far, and they want to be ready.
They've been expecting it, yeah.
Yeah, and they'll go after people, and I agree about martial law, suspending the Constitution. The other element they'll throw in is the element of fear. Maybe they'll launch another war, Peter, and scare people that, you know, the terrorists are coming again. Maybe a second 9/11 attack. You know, you just martial. The one thing that Trump's human need is fear that, you know, a terrorist is going to come and shoot you, or somebody's going to bomb your community. I mean, that really gets people's attention if they can believe it. So they might pull that stunt again. It seems to work every time. I don't know why they wouldn't do it. So maybe, you know, an Iranian threat, a Syrian threat, maybe a Russian threat, a Chinese threat. I mean, these guys will do anything to scare people and keep them in line. But I think martial law is part of it. NDAA, New Year's Eve signing, National Defense Authorization Act signing last year by Obama, authorizing the military to arrest U.S. citizens, put them in military prisons, uncharged or whatever, leave them there forever, or try them in military tribunals. I mean, this is hardball police state stuff. This is tyranny, and that is now the law
of the
land.
And the laws are in place.
Oh, it's coming. It's coming. I mean, it's here. It's already here. And they can, and Obama, on his word alone, can initiate this, can tell the military to go do this, do that on U.S. soil. And it wasn't all that long ago they're doing it, before we hit the new millennium, before around 2003, when NORTHCOM, the North American Command, was established around the same time Homeland Security was established, a couple of years after 9/11, or maybe a year after 9/11. And now U.S. troops can go out on U.S. streets, and I think they've got them. I mean, there are U.S. bases all over the country. They can get these troops, Army, Marine, whatever, put them out on U.S. streets. I wouldn't be too happy going up against the Marines. All I have are my arms and legs and my spirit. I certainly don't have any weapons, and I wouldn't want to use them if I did.
Absolutely, yeah. And you're told to be afraid. And if there's civil unrest in the cities, that implies a whole lot of people of color being involved, and then the vanilla suburbs become paranoid, many of which are armed, and they you know, the weapons come out. And we're fighting each other instead of trying to take on the power structure of this huge monolithic government corporate banking structure worldwide. I mean, the people in Greece and the people in Spain are strongly resisting, you know, the 15M movement in Spain, the, you know, all of this. They're saying, no, we are not going to cooperate with this government. We will interfere. We will surround your parliaments. And the police have been getting quite brutal. Ultimately, these are not desperate homeless folks inside the city. These are young activists and engaging in revolutionary resistance. It's nonviolent. But every revolution that's going to be successful today is going to have to be nonviolent. It's going to have to be non-cooperation. Violent ones just are not succeeding. Not if there's a militarized police state in place. You can't.
Peter, I have my idea of a perfect revolution. The only problem is getting it organized and doing it. And I mentioned it on the program yesterday. I've mentioned it before. Completely nonviolent, completely working people on their own, and people who want to work, who can't find jobs, outside of the control of unions, because the union bosses are in the tank. They're corrupted, and they simply don't work for the interests of the rank and file. But the way to really get the attention of the country and get real change, if enough people decided they would do it and they would stay the course no matter how tough it was, and I'm talking about a general strike, where people just don't go to work. The cops can't touch it. What are they going to do, come into every household and beat up people in their bedroom, in their living room?
Just it's called a general strike.
Exactly. Shut down the whole empire on the home front. The factories won't run. The Walmarts won't sell their goods. The McDonald's won't sell hamburgers. Everything will shut down. And I wonder how long it would take before something, the wheels would start turning, Peter, and there would be discussions about what can we do to do something for people who are hurting. Maybe they are hurting. Maybe we need to do something. Again, the cops couldn't do anything about people going on strike. That would be the way to get it done. The problem is, how on earth do you organize it? The music means a break. Peter, let's take a break and come back. If you have any ideas on that, I'm all ears.
We will
be right back. Peter Phillips, talking about the dire state of things. Peter, I'm eager for any thoughts you might have, and maybe we can also spend time in this half of the program talking about the possibility of more war erupting. I'm very, very fearful of it. I write so often on Syria, on Iran, and there's no question that Washington has longstanding regime change plans. I think they go back to the 1990s, maybe even early in the 1990s. My feeling is that Paul Wolfowitz might have been the germinator of these ideas, and that could go back a couple of decades. And it's just a matter of when they decide to implement the long-term plans that they have. And we know the ones they've already implemented, you know, the wars that have been fought, the occupations, Libya last year, Syria this year. After Syria comes Iran. So this is really, really serious. We could get ourselves involved in literally into a general war, which is a friendly word for saying World War III. The possibility is there. I don't know that it will happen, but the possibility is there. if we could only figure out a way to mobilize people here and in other countries, Peter, and the idea of some kind of a general strike shutting the country down, and just tune out what these people in power are saying and just stay the course and know that the system is rotten, it has to change, and the only way you're going to do it, well, the only way you can get their attention is simply shutting down their mechanism, their commercial enterprise, and that really hits them where it hurts. You hit the corporations where they hurt, right in their bottom line, and if that doesn't get the, well, that absolutely would get the attention of people in government. What do you think?
It's a general strike is certainly one long time possibility of major change. Certainly the general strikes in 1934, particularly on the West Coast, where we had a general strike in San Francisco that literally shut the city down. And, I mean, the only restaurants that remained open, the only the trucking, everything was shut down, were the ones the unions allowed. The people lived in hotels that could go have something to eat. It was a complete shutdown, and it was quite effective. In fact, the unions got not only the contracts they wanted for the longshoremen, but within a year, because of those general strikes in particular, in 1934, National Guard was called out more than any other year. Because of that particular year, that's when we got Social Security and the National Labor Relations Act, both passed in June the following, in 1935. And they'd tried to get what was called the Wagner Act through the year before, and they couldn't mobilize enough votes in Congress to get it through, which was, you know, to legalize unions and require, you know, employers to negotiate with unions. By 35, the civil unrest had reached such a level with general strikes occurring that the threat of a national general strike or a socialist, communist, grassroots mobilization that overpowered capitalism was so prevalent inside the elites, particularly in Washington. I actually read the transcripts from the Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Act for both years, in 34 and 35. In 35, everybody was testifying, saying that we needed to pass this legislation to prevent a communist revolution. And that was, it was clear. I mean, we could quantify it between the 2 years. So there was a real transition, a real change. Elites get just as afraid. They're just as scared. They're like the old plantation owners, knowing that they are very small in number and they're exploiting a whole lot of people out there. And that's why they spend so much money on the military worldwide. Ultimately, they know they can't, you know, control the world without, you know, some high-tech drone-based electronic manipulation 1984 like, and that we can't allow to happen. We can just not cooperate, period.
Well, it's amazing. I know there were some amazing things that happened in the 1930s. Of course, the echoes of the 1917 Russian Revolution, I guess, was still audible. And Roosevelt was really a conservative. He was a patrician, came from a very wealthy family. And he didn't start off initially wanting to do so much for so many people. I think basically his aim was, and of the people around him, and of some of the enlightened corporations. And I think back in those days, General Electric was one of the enlightened ones, and others like DuPont, I think, were very, very anti-Roosevelt. So anti, they wanted a coup to get rid of him. But the more enlightened corporations felt that it's better to give a little and save capitalism than risk losing the whole thing. But we have to make the people in power and the big corporate bosses think the same thing today. Gee, Peter, if it could work in the 1930s, why can't it work now? You've got a much stronger security apparatus in place. But if people decide they're not going to go to work, what good are the Marines going to do? I don't know what good they could do at all.
You're correct on that. They can't. I mean, they could prevent rioting in the streets and breaking into stores. But elites, you know, they can sit it out too. I mean, if the, I mean, this has to be, it's going to have to be global. Any singular country, if it's shut down, isn't going to transform the corporate elite class and capital, venture capital, worldwide. That's who's really playing the game today. All these big venture capitalist firms have primarily grown in the last decade. So it's the manipulation of capital. You don't build anything. You don't make anything. All you do is make money. And the governments continue to print more money. $16 trillion was loaned out to the central banks after 2007 to 2010. You just make more money, and it's manipulated even more. So stock prices, nothing is protected. Nothing is just market-oriented. It's all manipulated. So working people don't have a chance in that. And ultimately, our dollars will be worthless.
Yeah, we're coming to that, too. We really are coming to that. We don't have an inflation problem. Inflation is higher than the reported numbers, but we don't have anything approaching hyperinflation because the economy is weak, and you can tell when you're heading for inflation when bond prices start declining, when the yields start going up. Well, they're certainly higher in the troubled European countries, but than they are in Germany or France. Germany, I think, is very low interest rates, but in the peripheral countries, Italy, Spain, Greece, my God, Greece off the charts. You get high interest rates. Greece, especially, extremely high, but Italy, uncomfortably high. Spain, uncomfortably high. They ratchet up and down. America, so low in America. I don't know how it can stay that way that long. I mean, I can remember, back in the 1980s, when you could easily get double-digit return on Treasury securities, Treasury notes. In the early 1980s, Treasury short-term rates, I forget if they sold them weekly, but 3 months, 6 months, you could get double-digit returns on those. And if you bought anything longer, 5-year notes, 10-year notes, 30-year bonds, I mean, you've got much higher interest rates. And, of course, the world is the exact opposite today, where a 10-year bond, which is the working long bond, there's still a 30-year bond around, but it's mostly the 10-year bond. It's something like a 1.6-1.7% interest rate. Who would loan their money out for 10 years at 1.6 or 7%? It seems crazy to me, but that's the way it is. But when the threat of inflation really starts to rise, you're going to see those interest rates shoot up, and it'll take you by surprise. You'll never know when it's going to happen, and it goes up incrementally. It bounces back and forth, so people don't really know what's going on until they find themselves in an awful lot of trouble. But you've got currency debasement. You've got all the rest of it going on. A worldwide general strike, Peter, my God. It sounds like Mission Impossible to have a national general strike, a worldwide general strike. I think you mean mainly across Europe and America, throw Canada into that. Latin America has its own world. Asia has its own world. I don't know how you could mobilize a general strike in those parts of the world. Africa is completely different. But if you get Europe, And there were protests literally across Europe. I'm not certain there is any European country. I don't know about Norway, Sweden, Finland, places like that. But the northern countries, Germany, France, the southern countries, Spain, Italy, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, there have been protests on and off in all of these countries. And, of course, America with Occupy Wall Street a year ago. In Wisconsin, February, March 2011, there were the Wisconsin protests. Extraordinary. I mean, we need to get this thing cranked up again. All of it nonviolent. All of it nonviolent. But again, I think you need to throw the element of a general strike in, and you do that, and really the whole machinery just grinds to a halt.
I think it would be safer to say, I mean, I understand what you're saying, the world capitalist countries. And we're seeing resistance in a variety of places. I mean, China's unique in its own, and it is a totalitarian society. Russia is certainly in its own, and Russia and China are doing more trading and not using the dollar. They've agreed to that. But South America, of course, Hugo Chavez just won re-election overwhelmingly, and you know, by a million voters there, in excess of his opposition. And he's moving, he's out front. We're moving this country to socialism, and that, you know, and the people are supporting that. And we're seeing the same things going on in Ecuador and Brazil and, you know, Paraguay and other places in South America. So there's a whole movement of from bottom up to have the resources, protect the environment, and resist the northern capital penetration. So that is ongoing. So if they can do it in South America, we can do it here.
The difference in South America, not all of the countries, but a good number of them, the difference between the new millennium years and the 1990s, Jim Petras was on the program yesterday. I've quoted him a few times where he called the 1990s. Oh, my goodness, I know the term that he used. He referred to neoliberal plunder that was really institutionalized in the 90s. The decade of regional pillage. He had pillage in the thing he said, but neoliberal pillage just went on across the South American continent, Central America as well, and things just changed so drastically in the new millennium. Hugo Chavez came in February 1999. He just was reelected, as you said. We talked about the reelection yesterday, Peter. Really glorious. And the media, the major media in America across Europe, they beat up on him mercilessly. But my God, he's done so much for the Venezuelan people. Just reduced poverty drastically, unemployment drastically, deep poverty, cut it in half or more. I mean, the people are really indebted to him. I just couldn't imagine that he would lose. He won by 11 points. I'm not certain if there are still a few votes to be counted. There may be some expatriate votes that haven't come in yet that they're waiting for. But the latest count I saw a couple of days ago was something like 98.5 or 6%. So there's a percent or so, or maybe by now, there's virtually nothing left to be counted. And he had about an 11-point spread. And in America, they would call that a landslide. Usually it comes out 51-49, 52-48. I mean, that's a normal victory, one over the other. Obama got 58 in 2008, if I remember right. But that was because George Bush was hated so much. It's going to be a lot closer this time. Maybe it'll be a 52-48 election. I still think Obama's going to win, but who knows? Anything can happen. It depends on what the bankers want, Peter. But in Venezuela, oh, it's such a different world there. I can't imagine people going on a general strike there. There's no reason to do it. I mean, they've got a government that supports them. That really works for everybody. And Chavez is not unfriendly to business. He just wants a level playing field. He doesn't want the field tilted all one way and the people get nothing. And Venezuelans, before he was elected, were so brutally exploited. I'm not certain, but it might have been the most impoverished country in South America. It certainly was close, if it wasn't the most impoverished. But the people were just treated abysmally. I mean, they were furious. And finally, they got a guy who really did care about ordinary people. There aren't many people like him around, Peter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The banks in the U.S. are really backing Romney. There's huge amounts of money. I mean, Wall Street really supported Obama, 4 years ago. But this time, they're backing Romney. So, that's the reports I've seen recently.
I've seen the numbers, Peter. You're absolutely right. I went to Center for Responsive Politics, I think the name of it is, and they've got the latest information on contributions and the rest of it. And absolutely, I saw a chart of the leading Obama contributors and the leading Romney contributors, and you nailed it. The Wall Street banks are pouring the money into Romney, and that scares me because I've said it and I've written it, and I think it may be true that what the bankers want, they're going to get. If they really want Romney to be president, he's going to be president. That's very scary. I thought Obama would win for one reason, because Romney, I think, will end up being hated like George Bush. Does the power structure of America want to go through that all over again? They've got a guy in power who's given them virtually everything they want. The bankers are happy. They've certainly profited hugely from Obama. The other corporate interests have. America's rich has. And he's a consummate con man. After all the harm he has done, he's still got half the country conned. Do they really want to get rid of a guy like this and put a guy in office who I'm convinced will be roundly hated unless he is a guy who is able to change his spots? You never know what they're going to do, Peter, until they get a chance.
They
but he's a guy, based on his predatory business record, he scares the heck out of me.
I agree. Romney's, Obama, the moneyed elites don't trust him. Obama's been 4 years thinking about reelection. 4 years more without having to worry about reelection. They are very, very worried that he will do things to support working people, to challenge Israel more, in some ways that that's not acceptable to them. I think they'd rather see Romney in, who they can control better. Obama might take some steps beyond what he's shown so far. That's just speculative. I mean, that may be how they see it, but I really don't see that it'll make much difference. And I strongly support voting for a third-party candidate. We had Jill Stein here at our university just 2 weeks ago, and her platform is marvelous. The kinds of things that progressives would want to see. You know, a new deal for jobs, green jobs, full health care. I mean, it's everything that we want. So, I think that if millions of people vote for a third party, that's certainly a message. And there's 90 million people in the country who are eligible to vote that probably won't vote in this election. They could, if they decided to, in a massive way, make Jill Stein president.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Jill Stein, of course, the Green Party candidate. And, oh, I absolutely agree. Cynthia McKinney was the Green Party candidate in 2008. And they had the convention in Chicago. And Jill Stein this time, oh, absolutely, if enough people voted that way, it would be very, very tough. And most people never heard of Jill Stein and don't know very much of anything about the Green Party. But that would be a way to send the message. There's only one wrinkle in that, Peter. I don't know to what degree the machine controllers could change the way the election comes out, but we've got these corporate-run machines. They're programmed by the corporations, and they literally can make your vote turn into two votes for somebody else if they want to. And I mean, Al Gore won in 2000. He also won in Florida, that we learned some months later when it was too late. The matter of September, I think the New York Times even reported it, but they reported it in an article buried 20 paragraphs deep into their article, so few people even saw it, and then they couched their language, so you have to read it, and you have to read it again to be sure you understand what they're saying. That's the way they do things. But Gore won in 2000, Kerry won more convincingly in 2004, but George Bush was president, so they can manipulate things any way they want.
They clearly, we know that at least 8 million votes were changed in the 2004 election.
That is really, really shocking.
And it was in 34 states, 37 states, 13 states the exit polls matched. Now this year they're saying they're dropping exit polls on like half the states. They're not even going to do them. So, I mean, exit polls are very reliable ways of looking at is this election fair? And the 2004 election just simply wasn't. It's statistically impossible to have had the exit polls be so far off. In some states, it was several percent. And that was to give Bush a majority vote, even though, like in California, Kerry took the state. But he didn't take it by near as much as was predicted. And so this ultimately gave Bush a small 3 million vote plurality in the country. He lost probably by 5 million votes. And that Bush was never elected president, not fairly.
He sure wasn't. And, of course, the outrage of the Supreme Court when they stopped the vote recount in Florida. I'll never forget that, Peter. and never forget, how could justices call themselves legitimate when they literally stop a state from doing a perfectly legitimate legal recount, and they just stop the whole process, and five judges against four decided that they wanted George Bush to be president, so they annulled the entire popular vote, the entire vote across the country, and they alone got to pick the president. Shocking, absolutely shocking to this day. But they did it.
They did it.
I'm not certain what would have changed had Al Gore been president. If we had a 9/11 and we had a Gore as president, I'm afraid we still would have gotten these darn wars, Peter. Now, whether it would have been quite as bad as it was under Bush, I don't know. We'll never know. But I think we still would have gotten them. And, of course, the whole country was behind whoever was president. You know, I mean, the bad guys were named even though they weren't the bad guys. Everybody thought they were. And it was just a slam dunk to go to war with anybody you said was responsible. And that's exactly what happened. And then another war. And the stuff just goes on year after year, war after war. I fear there are two more coming. There's a war going on in Syria right now. I fear it'll be full scale, and that NATO will be involved in some way or other. Turkey is just itching to get into this thing, and they're waiting the word from Washington. I'm convinced of it. Syria is the lead Washington belligerent bordering on Syria. Turkey is the lead Washington belligerent bordering on Syria. And the ultimate target is to go after Iran. And the name of the game is not all the stuff that they talk about. The name of the game is getting rid of independent governments and putting in pro-Western ones. That's what Washington wants. It wants complete control, doesn't want any challenges. And Syria is independent. Iran is independent. Iraq was independent. Afghanistan was independent. Libya was independent. The common thread in all of these countries and anybody else that's independent, they get targeted for regime change. If you can't pull it off one way, you do it another way. It's a lot simpler to do it without a war. But if you have to, you go to war, and you can do it directly. You have proxy wars. There are proxy wars going on in Somalia, in Yemen. We've got drones. My God, you can have drone attacks anywhere. Media doesn't even report them. So all this stuff going on, and I think that's going to go on no matter who's president, Peter. It really is very, very scary. And our money, instead of those tax dollars spent for constructive purposes, so much of importance needs to be done at home. And you could grow the economy at the same time that you do this. It's not rocket science to grow the economy. Just from what I've done myself in my writing, Peter, I mean, if I had the power, dictate power, Peter, without anybody interfering with me, I swear to God I could get the economy moving, because it is not that complicated to do it. You've got to create money and use it to create jobs, to stimulate growth. You get people back to work, and if businesses won't do it, then you launch government projects. You build roads, you build bridges, you build dams.
Cooperatives.
Exactly.
You know, a billion people in the world work in cooperatives now.
Oh.
And that's growing massively.
Oh, another way, absolutely. And if you do enough of this, there's no limit to how much of this you can do. And there's so much that needs to be done in America. The infrastructure is crumbling. My God, you could create millions of jobs, and people who may not want to do this kind of work, if it meant eating, to do it to eat, or maybe you won't eat if you don't do it, they're going to go to work. They did it in the 1930s. They would do it now. And you get money in people's pockets, they're going to spend it, and that's the way the economy grows. But if you hand it to bankers to speculate and hedge funds, we stay in the same rut forever. We'll never come out of this.
You're absolutely right on that.
Peter, we're almost out of time. Final thought or two for you.
Well, I'm pleased to announce our new censored 2013 book is out. This year was done by Mickey Huff and Andy Roth. And Afif Ahmed did the introduction, Khalil Bendib, the cartoons. I've got a great chapter in there on the global 1%. But this was an independent, completely done outside of just my involvement this year as the former director of Project Censored. And we run the Media Freedom Foundation to keep it going. And we had a dozen universities participate this year. It's quite it's an amazing thing. It's out there, available online, and people ought to take a look.
Oh, I'm surprised, because when I had Mickey on, Peter, he said it would be available October 31.
Well, that's technically true, but Project Censored website, you can order it right now. We've got books.
Oh, had I known that, we would have spent more time talking about the book.
Well, let Mickey and Andy do that. That's their job. Great book.
Well,
I've read it.
Indeed. When I get Andy on, we will absolutely talk about the book. Oh, the book is absolutely extraordinary. I haven't seen the latest book, but I've certainly seen a number of the others, and they are absolutely extraordinary. And every year, the book seems to get better. I guess they build on each other, Peter. And they're marvelous. I mean, just jam-packed. They're collector's items, jam-packed from cover to cover with stuff you never read in the New York Times or see on
exactly.
TV news.
Right. A lot of what I said today is in the book. So.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Peter, it was great having you on. Time has run out. Even with an hour, the time elapses so fast. I really appreciate you coming on.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter. And I'll remind my listeners, of course, we're on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and on Fridays now at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.